Thanks everyone for being here. Welcome. I'm going to try to say this once tonight, which is that it's really an honor to talk about this halachic issue and preface that I'm not a doctor. So if there's any terminology that anyone wants to share, please feel free to do so. And I don't claim expertise in the medical side of things. So if you have any comments you'd like to add, please do so. I also like whenever I'm teaching a class and there's further reading materials that some people might be interested in, I try to bring resources that I think will be helpful. The one I brought tonight, it helped me prepare the class. It's a relatively new book by Rabbi Jason Wiener. And he is the senior rabbi and director of spiritual care at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center of LA. He was also the chavruta, the study partner of Rabbi Yonatan Cohen in Berkeley. They studied together, and he is an emerging leader in the field of medical halacha and medical ethics. This is one of several books I think he's written on the topic. But what I love about this book is that while there are many encyclopedic works on medical ethics and medical halacha, this is a book that offers a very comprehensive view of numerous issues. It does so in a concise way, and then offers you footnotes for further reading. So normally in the balance of accessibility versus in the balance between accessibility versus comprehensiveness, you end up sacrificing a level of complexity and nuance when you go for the kind of more beginner style books. This does a really good job of balancing the two. So it's called The Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making, and it's based on his expertise. He also has approbations from many gedolim, many halachic experts.
He's
not a doctor, but he works with them. I'm not a doctor, but many of my best friends are. He was at CBI,
yeah.
I think, 4 years ago.
He was really good.
Yeah, I've never heard him speak directly, but this book is excellent, and articles I've read were also very good. So our topic tonight is organ donation, mitzvah, or murder. And it's not so often that you can put those two words in the same sentence. But when it comes to the question of organ donation from a halachic perspective, oftentimes very slight differences in the standing of a question, it can be the difference between those two things. Sometimes you might even go further and say, is there an obligation, or is it such a strong prohibition that you would go as far as to call it murder? So this is an area of halacha that is complicated. What I'm going to do kind of just from the get-go is to say that we'll divide this into really three parts. The first part is going to be about living donations. So those are organ donations that can be made with a person being alive and well. That'll be our first part. Then we'll go into a second part about donation after death, which once, according to all definitions, a person is dead, because what is the context around donation? And third, last but not least, is the question of donation right around the time of death, and specifically, there are certain organs that, as far as I know, can only be donated if a person still has a beating heart. And so then you have to ask another question. The question is more foundational than, is it permitted to donate an organ at this time? Is this person alive or not? And that brings up a major both medical ethics question, but also a halacha question of what is the time of death? How does one determine death in Jewish law? So these are serious questions. I think for some of us, these are real life questions. They're questions that have happened to loved ones. But it's also very fascinating. So if anyone would like to pause with a specific kind of question or thing they'd like to add, please do so. For now, let's just jump straight in. Living organ donations. I think there's a real calculus in the halacha, similar to the one that's being made by medical ethicists, just we source our opinions from other sources, which is there's a risk and there's a reward, and the two things have to be balanced out against each other. The higher the risk of donating an organ, the less likely that it is going to be halachically permissible. And yet, the higher risk to the donor for now. We'll see cases where some poskim were worried about the recipients also being placed in risk. I'll just pause and mention a case of that. Many of the tshuvot that we're going to read tonight were written right as organ donation was becoming a viable medical option. And so in the early years, certain kinds of donation were extremely dangerous. I think particularly heart donations, heart transplants were, I think, very often not successful for recipients in the early years of heart transplants. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think heart transplants start to happen in the mid to late 70s and early 80s. This is also right around the time that defining death as brain death becomes the medically accepted consensus. So this... there was originally a lot of risk for recipients of certain kinds of transplants as well. But for now, let's talk about the risk of the donor and the reward for the recipient. So the higher the risk to the donor, the more likely that it's not going to be a mitzvah, but it might even be prohibited. And the higher the reward or the possibility of reward, as in the more likely that a donation is not only successfully received by the recipient, but the more likely that it affects their quality of life or that extends their life in a significant way, the more likely that you're going to say, well, that reward might outweigh certain levels of risk. So let's see, how do we evaluate those sources? How do we evaluate that balancing act from within our sources? So the first source that we have to discuss is a very often quoted verse in Vayikra, Leviticus chapter 19. I pulled this translation off of Sepharia. I understand why this is the translation, but I don't think this is the right translation. I understand where they get it from, but I don't think it's the right translation. So let me read the Hebrew and tell you my translation. The Hebrew in Vayikra chapter 19, verse 16, Lo telech rachil ba'amecha, do not go about as a talemonger among your people. So don't tell tales. This is one of the 8 or 9 prohibitions against Lashon Hara, against evil speech. That's the first part of the verse. And the second part of the verse is, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, do not stand upon the blood of your fellow, Ani Hashem, I am God. So the translation you have is, do not profit by the blood of your fellow. I think the way that translation gets developed is, Lo ta'amod could mean, do not stand yourself up by benefiting from the blood of your fellow. I think that's where the translation comes from. But classically, the way this source is interpreted, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, don't stand by your neighbor's blood, is don't allow a fellow Jew, and we'll see later this gets extended beyond Jews, but don't allow a fellow Jew to have their blood spilled. There's a mitzvah on Jews to make sure that fellow Jews don't get harmed and don't die. That's a positive commandment. And there are some who say that there's a negative commandment if you let it happen. So we are bound to not let other Jews get hurt and certainly die if there's anything we can do about it. So if you want to see this develop a little bit further, source two in the Talmud expands on this greatly. Last time I asked Allison to go first, so this time I'll go in the opposite direction. Terry, do you want to read source two for us?
Concerning the matter itself, it is taught in our Bereita.
Yeah.
From where it is derived, that one who sees another drowning in a river, or being dragged away by a wild animal, or being attacked by bandits, is obliged to save him. The verse states, you shall not stand idly by the blood of another.
So I'll ask you to pause there just for one moment. So that's the verse that we quoted, to start with. Do not stand idly by your brother's or your fellow's blood. And the Braita, which is a source from the times of the Mishnah about 2,000 years ago, expands on that extensively. What are the examples? Let's just think. What are the examples that were just mentioned that you should jump into a river to save someone who's drowning? That's the first example. If someone's being dragged away by a wild animal, presumably if that wild animal is strong enough to drag someone else away, they could probably hurt you too, right? If someone's being attacked by bandits, bandits are like the Talmud's language for murderers. So it's not just that they're there to take your wallet. It's that they're very likely to kill you too. So these are all life-threatening situations that another person is in. And the Talmud, quoting the Braita, says the verse that says, Lo tamod al dam re'echa, do not stand idly by your neighbor's blood, means that you have to go and save them. And so I think from the starting point, the Talmud is implying an important question of how much risk should a person be willing to bear in order to help another person stay alive. That's implied in this. And if I were to ask you offhand, is there a tolerance of full risk, of zero risk, or something in between? Just if this is all you saw so far.
And we're talking about Jews.
Let's assume for now we're talking entirely about Jews. I will try to get back to the non-Jewish question later on. So let me ask.
Well, based on justice.
Based on justice.
You should risk your own life to save another life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just based on
this one statement, right? And I think that's what the Talmud is trying to push us towards, that we have an obligation to really go out of our way, even at some personal risk, right? The Talmud doesn't say, even if you will certainly die, you should go and do this, but it says you should jump into a river that's at least dangerous enough for someone else to drown. Let's keep going, because the Gemara, you know what, actually, the Gemara goes into Talmudic hermeneutics here and trying to figure out, well, actually, you could have figured this out from another verse. The other suggestion that the Talmud has for where you would learn these laws from is from the mitzvah of Hashavat Aveda, returning lost objects. The verse that they quote is Deuteronomy chapter 22. The verse says, "V'hashevota lo," you shall surely return a lost object to one who has lost it. And the exposition here is, well, hashevota lo, if you have to return their lost object, you certainly have to return their life to the person who's about to lose it also. So saving a life is almost like returning a lost object. And then the Talmud kind of parses that out. Well, maybe I could have just learned saving lives from the lost object verse. Why do I need this verse too? And it's because to save a lost object, you don't have to spend your money. But to save someone's life, you certainly have to spend your money. You have to send off your servants if you have servants. You basically have to invest everything you have to save someone's life. And so that's why saving someone's life almost gets two verses versus returning lost objects that only has one. Okay, that's source two. There are other statements in the Talmud that also speak to this question of how much personal risk should I be willing to endure. The famous one is the Talmudic. This is almost like the Talmudic example of the rail card, the trolley car question, which is this is a classic philosophical question. I think from around 100 years ago, that if there's a trolley car going, I've taught a class about this. When I taught a class about the ethics of self-driving cars, this question comes up a lot because as people are deciding how to program self-driving cars, there have to be.
What's the scenario?
So the simple scenario, before there were Teslas that could make up their own minds about things, is that there's a trolley car that is currently going on a track, and there's someone stuck on the track, and the trolley car is about to override them. And if you can change, you can pull a lever, change a track, it will now go and divert from them. There are many versions of this, but the basic equation is that by changing the track, you might be able to reduce the number of people who die, but now you're taking an active role in their death. Let me start it again.
Yeah.
Track A that the trolley is currently on, or the train is currently on, has 100 people who are going to die.
Oh.
Or you can divert it to track B, and you'll save, let's say, 100 people, but it'll incur the death of one person. So you're going to save net 99 lives, but the difference is now you've taken an active role in the death of one person, as opposed to just having passively allowed 99 people to die. So there's a similar ethical question here, which is the Talmudic version of this. Let's say there are two people walking in a desert. You might have heard this statement in the Gemara before. Two people walking in a desert. One of them has a water bottle, and the other does not. And the classic question in the Talmud is, what should the person with the water bottle do? Should the person with, and they're talking about water skins, should the person with the water split the water in two and share it? Or should the person in the desert keep the water for themselves? This is a famous statement of Rabbi Akiva that emerges from this question. And it's a similar kind of question that I can passively save myself, or at least hopefully save myself by keeping all the water for myself. But in doing so, I will have passively allowed someone else to die. That's the classic setup of this question. What's the better ethical decision?
But if each person half of the water, it's not enough to sustain either, then you're responsible for both deaths.
Okay, so that's one permutation of it. Let's read the source in the Talmud and then speak about speak about the simple reading of the Talmud, and maybe some creative readings of it as well. Pauline, would you like to read source 3 for us? This is the Gemara in Bava Metzia, 62a.
The Gemara asks about this derivation. But is this...
Let's go to source 3, if that's okay.
One sentence, excuse me.
My bad, yeah.
And Rabbi Yohanan, what does he do with this verse? And your brother shall live with you? The Gemara answers, he requires the verse for that which is taught in a baraita. If two people were walking on a desolate path, and there was a jug, kiton, of water in the possession of one of them, and the situation was such that if both drink from the jug, both will die, as there is not enough water. But if only one of them drinks, he will reach a settled area. There is a dispute as to the halakha. Ben Petora taught, it is preferable that both of them drink and die, and let neither one of them see the death of the other. This was the accepted opinion until Rabbi Akiva came and taught that the verse states, and your brother shall live with you, indicating that your life takes precedence over the life of the other.
So this is a very famous, the final words in the statement of the Talmud is, Chayecha kodmin l'chayecha vercha, that your life comes first, kodem, to the life of your fellow. That you have to protect your life before the life of another.
So where did you get that from? Your brother will live with you.
That's great. Thank you. The verse there is, V'chai achecha imach, let your brother live with you. And the interpretation of it is, only when you are alive are you obligated to sustain the life of your brother. But if you will die in the process of sustaining your brother's life, there's no obligation to sustain their life. So it's only when there is an imach, that you are obligated to let your brother live. As in, that's Rabbi Akiva's really creative interpretation of this verse. This,
you know, Rabbi.
Yeah.
Excuse me for interrupting, but this reminds me of the story of Hagar,
okay,
who is totally chastised because she turns away from her son who is going to die because of lack of water.
So you're asking...
So how can this situation, Rabbi Akiva, teach that it's okay for you to drink the water when you're going to have to see somebody else
die?
She didn't have any water.
I think that's the major distinction, is that neither of them had water. They were both going to die. And that's...
Yeah, but she turns her face... I mean, it's really clear that she is totally chastised for not offering any support or...
I've actually never read it that way. I've always understood it as a pained mother who can't bear to see the death of her child. I always thought of it actually as a moment of deep... It's not compassion as much as deep concern that a parent has for a child, so much so that they can't bear to see their child suffer. I hear how the setup is similar, because there are people dying in the desert for lack of water.
But she wasn't consoling this son who was going to die. She isolated. She turned away.
Uh-huh.
He was left there to himself without any kind of emotional support.
Yeah. I hear the question. I think on a just practical level, this is a case where there is some water. That was a case where there was none. I think the story there is teaching very different kinds of lessons than this statement in the Talmud. But I hear the comparison and I hear the question. I don't know that I'm equipped with a great answer right now. So let me bring it back to our kind of medical ethics question, which is the source number 2, this, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, suggests that from the verse of Lo Tamar Al Dam Re'echa, from the verse of don't stand idly by your fellow's blood, you're obligated to go under some personal risk, right? To jump in the river, right? Fight the bandits to save a fellow Jew, right? The second source in the Talmud seems to say that there once was an opinion of Ben Petora who actually took that view, but then Rabbi Akiva usurped it. And Rabbi Akiva said, Chayecha kodmin. That's the famous line from, those are the famous two words of Rabbi Akiva. It summarizes his position. Your life comes first. You're obligated to save other lives, but when there's a debate between your life and someone else's, you have to prioritize your own. So now let's plug this into our question of organ donation. right? Or when is the limit between when are you obligated to endanger yourself, right, to save someone else? That would be the suggestion of Sanhedrin 73, right? That you should take on some risk. But well, it seems to be that the risk you should take on, if you're just going to juxtapose these two verses, these two sources against each other, is that you should only take risk when it's not going to lead to your certain death. But if you're certainly going to die in the process, right, better that you should let another person die than you undergoing a significant risk on your own. We'll eventually have to talk about, well, not all risks are created equal, and one of the challenges of assessing risk is that you don't have certainty around these questions. But we're starting to set up a kind of a paradigm for ourselves. It's important to say that just in the halachic conversation, something really fascinating happens. That Rabbi Akiva's opinion was not, even after Ben Petorah, let's say the takeaway of source 3 in the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud suggests that the halacha is according with Rabbi Akiva, right, which is you put your own life priority first. There is a separate statement in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the Jerusalem Talmud, that disagrees with this position of Rabbi Akiva, or seemingly disagrees with this position of Rabbi Akiva. So just for a quick background, right, the Mishnah is written in the year 200. The Talmud is really a misnomer because there are two Talmuds. The two Talmuds are commentaries on the Mishnah. The Talmud, Yerushalmi, the Palestinian Talmud, is codified around the year 400 and something. The Babylonian Talmud takes a few hundred more years to develop. Generally speaking, the Babylonian Talmud is more authoritative because more Jews lived in Babel, in Babylon at that time. However, when there are often, not always, but there are often disagreements between the two Talmuds themselves. And this is a case of disagreement. This case of disagreement is in Trumot. Trumot is the tractate of Mishnah and of Jerusalem Talmud that discusses the laws of giving gifts to the priests, to the Kohanim, Truma. However, anyone know, there's no Babylonian Talmud on this tractate. Anyone know why?
It doesn't apply.
Because Truma, right, the gifts to the Kohanim only apply in the land of Israel, and the Babylonian Talmud is the Talmud of the exile, so they didn't have those laws to deal with. So there's no Talmud Bavli on this. But in the Gemara in Shumot, there's a story that's written about a certain Rav Isi, who's a pretty well-known Tana, rabbi of the Mishnah. Rav Isi is captured, and presumably his life is endangered on the line. He's captured, and he's imprisoned. And Reish Lakish, famously known as the student and the friend of Rabbi Yochanan, Reish Lakish basically gets up and says, I am going to go and get back Rav Isi. And either I will kill or I will be killed, but I'm not just sitting at home and waiting for Rav Isi to die. Okay, so Reish Lakish has just suggested, at least in the Jerusalem Talmud, that how much risk should a person undergo to save a fellow Jew?
100%.
100% risk. Right. And according to the Yerushalmi, at least according to one story in the Jerusalem Talmud, a person should risk their life entirely. You'd have to reinterpret that verse that Rabbi Akiva worked with. Right? Rabbi Akiva says, V'chai echecha imach, let your brother live with you. Right? Maybe he'd have to say, only if your brother is alive do you have the right to be alive. It's kind of a flipping of the verse. So there's a fascinating question here of what do you do with that Talmud Yerushalmi. So I'm now going to pause and just do a moment of the history of halacha. The halachic process has its own history. And what happens with that source in the Talmud is that Rabbi Yosef Cairo, who writes the Code of Jewish Law in 1550, Rabbi Yosef Cairo quotes this Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, in his earlier work, and then leaves it out of the Shulchan Aruch, of the Code of Jewish Law. And the Code of Jewish Law becomes the most authoritative text of Jewish law ever since 1550. So he left out the Jerusalem Talmud, and later rabbis are left to say, one second, if he quoted it in his earlier work of the Beit Yosef, why does he leave it out of the Shulchan Aruch? And many commentaries suggest the reason he left it out is because he thinks the Babylonian Talmud is more authoritative on this specific issue. As in, by leaving it out, Rabbi Yosef Cairo decided that what is the practice halacha is Rabbi Akiva over Reish Lakish. And so what is our practice halacha? It is that you don't put your own life on the line in order to try to save someone else's against that story. parenthetically, I think it's interesting that Rish Lakish is the figure who says, I'm going to go up and get killed, either kill or be killed, because we know Rish Lakish's history is that before becoming a scholar, he was the head of the bandits. That's what the Talmud says about Rish Lakish. That's an interesting biographical note. Let's turn to the next page. So, if you take the position that you're not allowed to risk your own life, let's say you're not going to risk your life. Let's say there are procedures that carry little to no personal risk. Are there any other halachic issues that have to be dealt with? And so it's just worth putting out one other halachic issue around organ donation. And that is a prohibition that is known as chavala. Chavala is basically a wide catch of a prohibition that says you're not allowed to injure your own body. Next week, when we talk about...
that self-mutilation type thing?
Self-mutilation in the Torah has some very specific definitions of like scarring your body as a mourning rite, tattoos. Those are specific biblical prohibitions. This is much more all-encompassing, that a person's not supposed to injure their body, period, on any form of injury. There are some people who say that you shouldn't like do extreme sports for this reason, because certainly smoking cigarettes, you can make it strong case that that's actually a form of murder, like self-imposed murder, because the likelihood that smoking cigarettes is going to shorten one's life significantly, I'm not the doctor in the room, but I think is quite significant. On the other hand, playing extreme sports, I don't know that there's any research that says it'll shorten your life, but it's certainly likely that you'll break a few bones along the way. I remember a rabbi in Israel who said it was forbidden to ski. Because it was just too likely that you were going to cause injury. Chavala, so just going back to this prohibition of chavala, this comes up much more as a halachic issue when it comes to next week's topic of cosmetic surgery. Cosmetic surgery is elective surgery under many cases, not always. And when it's an elective surgery that doesn't have any mitzvah benefit to it, right? This becomes a much more relevant source. So we'll go back to this next week. For now, if you want to look at this specific prohibition, you can find it in source 5 in the Mishnah in Bava Kamma. What's the answer to that prohibition of chavala? Why might I say that even if there's a prohibition not to injure your body, that could be overridden? What would be the logical framework to override that prohibition?
To save a life, right?
This is the general catch-all in halacha, that pikuach nefesh, saving a life, overrides Shabbat. We'll get back to that later.
So you can take a kidney from a living person to save a life of someone who's, you know, on dialysis and can't.
Great. Something like that. So, yes, and that's the reason why. Just to summarize it, saving lives, pikuach nefesh, overrides all but three prohibitions in the Torah. And those three are murder, idolatry, and certain forms of sexual relations. Adultery, etc. So barring those three, you can violate 610 of the commandments in the Torah. Right? And chavala, in all likelihood, is only a rabbinic prohibition to start with. Mm-hmm. So certainly you could override that. But it's just worth putting that out, because doing surgery is just... even if there's zero risk in a surgery, it doesn't just mean... go ahead and do it. There are other prohibitions related to it. You can make similar arguments about certain kinds of body art, etc., and we'll get there next week. So in trying to put this all together, the consensus among poskim, when we're talking about live donation, seems to be that if the amount of risk to life is minimal, and I've seen some poskim describe this as like 2-4% or less of significant risk to one's own life as a donor, then the level, I put together a summary based on this book from Rabbi Wiener, right? Then most poskim will say that it's encouraged, sometimes even obligated, to do certain forms of donation when there's very low risk. An example of when it's an obligation is if you have a person you know who says, I need a bone marrow transplant or I'm going to die. And that's often is the case. And bone marrow transplants have, they're uncomfortable, but they're very low risk in terms of the outcome for the donor. So then it's certainly a mitzvah. All the poskim agree it's a mitzvah. There's a debate among the poskim of, is it actually a chiyuv, is it an obligation or not? Many poskim suggest from earlier sources that you can't force a person to put themselves in any harm's way or any significant discomfort. Like you, even if it's just getting ill, you can't force someone to get ill. And I don't think there's really any form of transplant other than blood donation when there's no side effect whatsoever or anything more than the most minimal of side effects. Blood donation, some people say, is an obligation. Is it a chiyuv? Because there is absolutely no downside for the vast majority of people. It might be an obligation. I need to take my own words because I'm terrified of needles and I should be donating more blood than I do. The last time I donated blood, I think I almost passed out. Not because it was harmful at all, but because I just don't like needles. Okay, so that's kind of at the one end of the spectrum. Middle end is that there are certain kinds of donations that do come with some risk. An example of that probably is a kidney donation. Kidney donation is low risk, but it does have some risk. I'm not going to claim to know the science. I'm told that liver donations are significantly more risky. They're not minimal. They're kind of somewhere in the middle range. And that lung lobe, so that's a partial lung donation, are also in that kind of category of significant risk. Many poskim there will say, it's a beautiful thing if you do it. It's a mitzvah if you do it, but we're not going to push anyone to go ahead and do it.
Rabbi,
yeah.
But a liver donation would mean that the donor is dead because you only have one liver.
You can spare yeah. one.
I think there are partial liver donations.
You can do partial liver sections, and the liver will rejuvenate. It's the one organ, one of the organ that can rejuvenate.
Okay. So let's assume that for now we're talking about a partial liver donation. Later on, we're going to talk about a complete liver donation. And the last category that I couldn't think of a good example of in terms of an organ where the risk is very high. I can't think of a very high risk that won't certainly kill you organ. But I think an example of a very high risk is someone who's immunocompromised, who even if, let's say it's a kidney donation, and even if kidney donation under most circumstances would not have high risk, but if a person has other medical challenges or issues, then it does become high risk, just because any procedure for some people could be high risk.
No doctor would take you as a donor under those circumstances.
Right, because doctors are compelled by their own medical code.
Right.
But halachically, it would actually become problematic because of chayecha kodmin, because your life has to come first. The Rabbi Akiva principle says you're not allowed to let yourself die in order to save someone else's life.
Can that change at all if you're talking about donating for your own spouse or child?
I think in the first two categories of minimal risk and significant risk, yes, the balance can change there. But if it's certainly going to kill you, I think there's actually an important Jewish ethics principle around health that gets underspoken about. This comes up in abortion issues also, is that we don't own our own bodies. From a Jewish perspective, we don't have, no one else owns our bodies either. God owns our bodies, right? And so I think there's an important point to be made about many kinds of medical issues, abortion being one of them. So
suicide
certainly being an example of that. I don't have the right to, I don't have total autonomy over my own body because my body doesn't belong to me. My body is lent to me by God for however long God gives me to spend on this earth. And I think for that reason, even if there was a very strong family pull of like, I want to do this, but then the doctor says, no, this is going to kill you. That might halachically, I can't speak to the enormous pain that a person who had to make that decision would be going through, but halachically, I don't think there is any leniency for a person to give up their own life with high level of certainty. Okay, so that's case one. Case two, actually a few final points there. I found one interesting kind of caveat to cases where you're not forced to do a donation, but maybe under some permutations you would be. let's say for the poskim who say that even a minimal risk procedure, a person cannot be forced to do. There's no chiyuv, even though it's a mitzvah. There's no obligation, even though it's a mitzvah. I saw one tshuva that if a person has already promised to donate their bone marrow, at that point, let's say they promise to donate their bone marrow, and then a week into the process, they schedule the procedure, and then the person says, I just can't do it. I'm too afraid. I saw one tshuva saying that halachically, the person is obligated to finish their commitment and to actually go in for the procedure. Because at that point, so once you've made the promise, the recipient has already started priming in a medical facility to receive the transplant. And I believe that compromises their own immunity in doing so. I once, I signed up for, what's it called? Gift of Life. I'm on the Gift of Life registry. I hope everyone else here is too. It's a registry of, you just have to swab your cheek and you become, they take your DNA and you go onto a registry for bone marrow transplants. And I did it back in Israel probably 14 years ago. And then when I was in rabbinical school, I got a call out of nowhere. I forgot that I'd even done it, saying, we think you're a match for someone who's in need of bone marrow. And I ended up going through a several month long process. And I decided I was going to do the form of bone marrow transplant where they can filter something out of your blood. It's okay. And so I started going.
Do you have to take it out of the spinal column?
There are two different kinds of bone marrow transplants. This is the less significant of the two for the donor. But I'm terrified of blood. So this was not something I wanted to do it. And I was also terrified. Like, really terrified about doing it. But I went in anyways, and I think it was about a week or two before the procedure, I got a call and said, the recipient no longer needs your services. It could either mean that they got a lot better or a lot worse, to the point where they were not a candidate for to be a recipient anymore. In any case, if you had made that commitment, I saw at least one shuva that says, once you sign on the dotted line saying you're going to do it, to pull out at that point, you're essentially going to be killing the recipient who has compromised their immunity in order to become a recipient. If they don't get the transfusion, then they're almost certainly going to die. And at that point, you do become, even if according to the opinions that a low-risk procedure is not an obligation, once you commit to it, it becomes an obligation.
But if once you agree, they're not going to look for anybody else.
Well, it's more, I think it's more that once you agree, they start preparing the recipient to... I think they take them off certain medications. Sheldon, it looks like you can speak to that better than I can.
The point of bone marrow transplant is to replace the person's bone production cells that you've completely eliminated because of the cancer.
So if they don't receive it...
If they receive it, they have no immune system.
And then it's kind of a matter of time. So in any case, that's a point where it might become a chiyuv. Okay, so part one that we just are wrapping up now is live donations. A low risk donation of an organ is likely not an obligation, but an exceedingly pious thing to do. I've seen there's a whole movement in the Orthodox world now where many rabbis are starting to donate their kidneys. I've seen more and more articles in the last few years about it. The risks have become lower and lower over the last number of decades, and the benefits, you're certainly saving people's lives when you do that. I think that's a really pious thing to do. It's certainly a mitzvah, but the consensus seems to be that you can't force people into it, that you would never line people up in shul on a Sunday morning and say, okay, you're going to donate on Monday and you're going to donate on Tuesday, that you would never go ahead and that far. Okay. Dead donors, you might take for granted, but there's a long, long-standing Baba Misa, kind of grandmother's tale, that this is absolutely pasnished. This is like absolutely not appropriate. Those are like the four words of Yiddish that I feel very comfortable using. So I certainly remember when I was becoming more observant that this was totally off the table. People, I think, are trained to think this way because of what they think about autopsies. A lot of people have heard that you can't do autopsies on Jewish bodies for the reason of desecrating the dead. And this idea of desecrating the dead is a real idea. So let's spend a moment talking about it. Where does it come from? Comes from a verse in Devarim and Deuteronomy. This is verse 7. Chapter 21 of Devarim talks about what if someone is hung on a tree as capital punishment. So there are times where that is the capital punishment inflicted by a Beit Din, by a rabbinical court. We haven't done this in 2,000 years, but that's a parenthesis. And the second verse there, this is the third line in the English, and third line in the Hebrew, is Lo talin nivlato al ha'etz. Once you have hung them, do not let their bodies hang on the tree. Ki kavor tikbarenu, rather you shall surely bury them. And the Hebrew there is a doubling of the verb. And a doubling of the verb in Hebrew, kavor tikbarenu, is always a strengthening of whatever should be done. So it's not only should you bury them, you really, really, really should bury them. There's a doubling term there. Bayomahu, on that very day. And that's where this idea comes from, that we try to do burial within a day of a person dying. So this pasuk in the Torah, this verse in the Torah, is telling us a few things. First thing it's telling us is that there's a level of kavod hamet, dignity of the deceased, even for someone who is liable for the death penalty, right? Kal v'chomer, all the more so, you would assume, for someone who was not put to death by a Beit Din, by a rabbinical court, right? Someone who is a more upstanding citizen. So from here, the Talmud says very clearly that one is not allowed to desecrate the dead. But then the Talmud says, let's say waiting more than a day is a desecration of the dead, right? I think that's pretty clear from this verse. You should bury them on that day. Don't make them suffer, right? Very strong languages. Very strong language in the Torah. The Talmud in Sanhedrin, source 8, 47a, says, well, one second, there are some cases where waiting an extra day might not desecrate the body of the dead, but might actually bring dignity to the body of the dead. Can we think of it? Could anyone think of an example of when delaying burial brings added dignity instead of desecration?
In a war.
Okay, in a war. So you'd be able to bury someone, let's say, next to their family, as opposed to an anonymous grave in the middle of nowhere. Okay. Any other cases? If you looked ahead at, and thank you for not doing that, the Gemara gives a few examples of what if a person doesn't have burial shrouds? But if you wait an extra day, you'd be able to procure the burial shrouds, like, say, the Hanukkah miracle, right? If we could only have an extra few days, we'd have more oil. But if we could wait an extra day or two, we'd have burial shrouds. Or if it's a place where people bury in coffins, right, which Jewish history has had different minhagim, different customs around that. But let's say it's a place where everyone's buried in coffins. You don't have a coffin today, but if you wait a day or two, you might get a coffin, right? And then the Talmud says explicitly, because this verse is, this is an example of Darshin and Taimed Ikra, where you expound on the reasoning behind the prohibition. The prohibition is do not wait a day before burial, even for someone who's been put to death, right? What's the reasoning behind that prohibition? Honoring the dead, kavod hamet. There's a prohibition of nivul hamet, not desecrating the bodies of the dead. But if the waiting is for the sake of honor, right, then the waiting becomes permitted. The Talmud says that explicitly. The common application of this nowadays is the leniencies around waiting longer for burial
for
relatives to come. Yeah, that's probably the most common application of this source in the Talmud, that really there is a biblical obligation to bury within a day. In Jerusalem, there's no leniency about this. The custom in Jerusalem, that actually comes from the verse itself, right, that it's Bayom HaHu, on that very day.
Except
right?
If it's a Yom Tov.
In Jerusalem, there's some wacky things happening on Yom Tov, too, with regards to burial. In the Hasidic community. Let's not go there right now.
Okay.
But, yeah. The Talmud talks about burial on second day Yom Tov. We're asking non-Jews to do it. Let's not go there now. So there is an obligation, but when, let's say, kavod hamet, when we could assume that the dead person would have been more dignified if their sister had come from across the world, right? Then you can actually override the simple reading of that verse, because the whole purpose of that verse is to honor the dead, and this brings them more honor. So how does that apply here when it comes to organ donation? If you can make a reasonable claim that so-and-so who passed away, it would be a credit to them, right? They would be happy about, be happy to extend the period before burial so that they can have an organ taken out of their body and given to a needy recipient. Or that despite the fact that there is some level of nivul hamet, there is a desecration of the dead's body that would come from an organ from an organ transplant, taking it from their body. But if you can say that really they would want this and it would be a dignity, it would be a good thing for them, then you can override these prohibitions, similar to what the Talmud has just said about waiting the extra day. That's the general consensus. There are communities that do not accept that. There are certainly communities that basically say, like, sorry, we're just not touching our dead bodies ever under any circumstances. I think if you go into the more, in certain parts of the more ultra-Orthodox world, you see very, very little organ donation whatsoever. That's something that rabbis nowadays are trying to address more directly. Even donations from dead bodies. In many ultra-Orthodox communities, you won't see it at all. Because of that concern of evil inmates, of desecrating the bodies, desecrating dead bodies. Interesting question that comes here. Do you require, what if a person did not have a signature on the back of their license saying that I want to be a registered organ donor? Or what if you don't know? What if a person had not given prior consent? So this is an interesting debate, a question. There's a principle in the Talmud called Zachin La'adam Shelo B'fanav. We can do something meritorious for a person even if they're not in front of us. It's a principle that comes up in the context of Beit Din, of rabbinical courts. The famous example of it is, how on earth do you convert a minor to Judaism? How do you convert a child to Judaism? We were speaking about this last week. It's very clear that to do a halachic conversion, it requires da'at, it requires cognition on behalf of the person being converted. So that's very good for an adult who has a clear mind. But what about a three-month-old? 3 months old can't make up their own decisions. And so the Talmud applies this principle of Zachim la'adam shelo b'fanav. You can do something meritorious for a person even if they're not there right now. And that's the basis in which the Talmud says that if the minor doesn't have da'at, doesn't have cognition, a Beit Din, a rabbinical court, can stand and use their cognition in place of the minor and say, we're going to make up our minds that this minor will be converted. And we'll do it because it's a schut, it's a merit for them. Then you have to get into the question, well, if this minor is just going to have a pro forma conversion and never keep a single mitzvah in their entire life, is that really a merit? Or have you just incurred upon them lots and lots of negative checks, you know, on the scale of judgment? Are they going to do lots of things that they were not supposed to do and not a whole lot of mitzvot? Maybe then it's not a schut, and that's where major debates around conversion standards for minors come up nowadays. But this Talmudic principle stands, and some people apply it to the discussion of organ donation, which is, so-and-so lived a life, they stood by certain values, they were generous people, now they've died, and we don't know what they wanted, right? They didn't ever say it explicitly. They didn't have an advanced medical directive to decide, this is what I want to happen to me when I'm gone. And maybe you can say, well, so-and-so lived a life that would suggest to me that, A, they probably felt this was halachically appropriate because they were in this kind of community where that's encouraged. And B, they were generous people. And so it would be a schut for them. It would be a merit for them. And C, you're stacking up mitzvah points on their behalf when they can no longer do any mitzvahs on their own. Right? There is a case to be made. And this is a major ethical question on its own because you don't have their informed consent. That maybe you can say, well, we're going to stand in on their place, do a merit for them, even if they can't make up their own minds. I'm not going to say that that is the answer, but it is an answer that some people give. Okay. The last third case for us to discuss, and this is the most controversial of them, is removing organs that are life-sustaining. And so the two most common examples of this are heart transplants, lung transplants, when it's a whole lung, or I guess both lungs, and liver transplants when it's the entire liver. Because to Kirsten's point, you can't live without it, and as far as I understand, once the whole thing is gone, it doesn't come back. So what do doctors do? The common application is for people who want to do these transplants, that you wait until the point where there is you wait until the point where there is no independent breathing, and there is still cardiac function. To do these kinds of transplants, there still needs to be cardiac function until the moment that the organ is taken from the body. So there's, the heart still has to be beating. So how do you do this? Generally speaking, you wait for a moment that is called brain death. So brain death is, well, we'll get into the definition soon, is a point where the brain stem, which controls the most basic functions of life, like independent breathing, has stopped to signal to the lungs to breathe on their own. And at that point, the only way that you can keep the body physically alive by intubating the person, and that the intubation causes their lungs to expand and contract and breathe, it forces breathing, but they're not breathing independently anymore. And so the major question here is, well, if brain death is halachically called death, then if you take everything we've said until now, that there's a mitzvah to donate organs once a person has died, then donating a heart after brain death is a mitzvah. But on the other hand, if you take the position that brain death is not death, and the only proof of death in the in Jewish law is the stopping of cardiac activity, then a heart transplant, this is the common example that was used in the literature, a heart transplant is no longer a mitzvah, now it's actually, it's ritzicha, it's murder. And so when I said organ donation, mitzvah, or murder, this is the most clear case of that. Okay. For the sake of time, and if you're interested in this, please read Source 9 for yourselves later. Source 9 talks about a category of person that is known as a goses. A goses is a person who is imminently about to die, but has not yet died. Normally, we define this as someone who's on their deathbed, who's not going to be standing up anymore. You could imagine this as, I think in hospice terminology, they talk about this as probably something like the step right before active dying. I think that's the terminology that's used. Okay, so what is the halachic standing of a person in that moment? So the Shulchan Aruch, but this is not just the Shulchan Aruch, Maimonides says this, it's based in the Talmud directly, says that you're not allowed to do anything to hasten their death, but you are allowed to remove barriers from the death happening. That's a little nuanced.
Well, do you remember the case several years ago about the lady in Florida who was on tubes? She'd been that way for 11 years. She was in a vegetative state. And her husband wanted to divorce her. He couldn't because she was in a vegetative state. So he wanted to remove the tubes.
Uh-huh.
And the parents were against it. It was a big court case.
Is this in the Jewish community?
No, this wasn't Jewish. But it's
okay.
Still applicable.
Yeah.
It happens. So well, the question is, can you remove a feeding tube from a person?
Yeah.
You've been feeding, keeping them alive. I don't know if she was on total support, but she was certainly on a feeding tube. The question is, can you remove the feeding tube? She can't eat by herself. She will eventually die.
It's a great question. I have stuff to say about it, but it's beyond the scope of tonight. And it's actually a class that I've wanted to do with Jessica Zitter for a long time. And we keep talking about teaching something like that together. At some point we might. And I'd be happy to talk to you offline about it. But that is, end-of-life issues are in some ways separate from this discussion right now. So let's say for now, we'll take the position that if a person is still halachically alive, anything that hastens their death is active murder. If a person is actually alive, there are many of these examples given in Source 9. Probably the most jarring one is that you're not allowed to close someone's eyes in the moments before their death, because the act of closing their eyes, any disturbance to their body whatsoever, could bring the death a little bit closer. And any active activity that brings a person's death a little bit closer is considered an act of murder. On the other hand, turn to the top of the next page. So we're continuing in Source 9 from the second page to the third page. You should see the box having a new paragraph with a bold word, Rama. So the Rama says, and this is important, so I'm going to read it in the English. Rama is Rabbi Moshe Israelist. He wrote the Ashkenaz gloss to the Code of Jewish Laws of the Shulchan Aruch. It is similarly forbidden to cause the dying to die quickly, such as someone who is a goses, that means they were imminently about to die, for a long time and cannot separate it, so they can't fully leave this world. It is forbidden to remove the pillow or mattress from underneath him. However, This is the big exception. If there is something that causes the hindrance of the departing of the soul, such as a loud knocking noise near the house, like a woodchopper, or salt on his tongue, and these are stopping the departing of the soul, then it is permitted to remove them, since there is no action from these things. Rather, one is just removing the hindrance.
So that's totally relevant with what I said about feeding tubes.
Yeah, except that I don't want to enter the discussion, because it has too many medical ethic complications around it, and I just want to stay in the context here of organ donation. So here, that source just sharpens the problem. Because so long as a person is alive, any action that will make them die quicker is murder. But once they are dead, right, or once they are dead, there's no prohibition. Or there any prohibition about organ donation is presumably overridden by the value of saving someone else's life afterwards. So defining the moment of death is extremely relevant to this question. And that brings us to source 10. So source 10 brings us to the principle of sefing nefashot, any possibility of saving a life, overrides Shabbat. This Mishnah and then the following comments in the Talmud is the defining source for the discussion around brain death in Jewish law. And I'll summarize it for you. The Mishnah in source 10 in Masechet Yoma, chapter 8, gives an example of when a house has fallen over on Shabbat. And you can imagine a house has fallen over, there's tons of debris, there are heavy rocks, and you don't know if there are survivors in the debris. That's the setup here. And so what does a person do? Well, we're going to apply the principle. If there is a risk or a doubt about anyone being alive, right, then you're obligated to start removing debris, which is at the very least a rabbinic issue of just working very hard, and at the worst could be maybe an act of soter, of destroying something, which might be biblically prohibited. But you're going to override it if you think there might be people there. So how far do you go? As in, how much debris do you remove? And when are you no longer allowed to keep removing debris? That's the question that the Talmud wants to ask. And this is source 11, the Gemara in Yoma 85a. The Gemara starts with the question, how far does one search? Ad heichan hu bodek? And the Gemara gives two answers. The first answer is bodek ad chotamo. You search until you find the nostrils. So you can imagine this is tragic, but this has happened in real life in our generation too. This is not just a Mishnah situation. When you're removing debris and you find a body, and you've removed debris to the point where you've exposed the head, right? What's one way to see if this person is still alive? And if they are alive, then you have to continue digging them out. And if they're not alive, then you're not allowed to continue digging them out, and you have to wait till after Shabbat to remove their bodies. So you check to see, is there any breathing happening? And the way you check it is just by putting your finger next to their nose and seeing, can you feel any breath going out of their nose? That's the first opinion. The second opinion, though, in source 11 says, Yesh omrim, there are those who say, ad libo. That even if you got to their nose and you don't feel any breathing, you have to continue to dig until you expose their heart. And then I guess you have to feel the heart and see if there's a heartbeat. And so this becomes the major essence of the debate. How do you determine death in Judaism? Mm-hmm. This is the Talmudic material that we're going to work with. One opinion says you check the breath, and the other opinion says you check the heart. And so my nafkamina, what's the practical difference between these positions? So the practical difference, right, between these positions is the first opinion suggests that if a person is not breathing, even if their heart might still be beating, they are now defined as dead. Okay, that's the first opinion. The second opinion says a person may not be breathing independently. However, as long as they are, a person might not be independently breathing, but if their heart's still beating, they're still alive. And so the practical outcome here is brain death. Right, brain death is when the brain stem has stopped sending any signals telling the lungs to breathe. But you can be brain dead and still on a breathing apparatus, and you can be intubated, the breathing machine, and the body could continue to function even without independent breath. And that's this. All the poskim who deal with this question go back to this source in the Talmud. And what is it? How do we evaluate death? Is it the nose or is it the heart? Is it breath or is it pulmonary or is it cardiac function? The Gemara concludes with Rav Papa And the Gemara's conclusion is that really the essence of life is felt from the nostrils. It actually quotes a verse to prove this point. It's the top of the fourth page. There's a verse in the Torah that says, I think it's in Mishlei, sorry. Kol asher nishmat ruach hayim ba'apav. Anything that has the soul of the wind of life in its nostrils. That seems to be the defining feature of life. Okay, and Rashi here says, Rashi commenting on the Talmud, this is verse 12, that you have to check until his nose. Right, that seems to be the Talmud's conclusion. You check till the nose. Rashi says, and if there is no life in his nose, that he is not exhaling breath, then he is surely dead, and one should leave him until after Shabbat. So the simple reading in the Talmud seems to be that what defines life? Independent breathing, and not the heart. However, here's when we're going to get into the kind of hermeneutics and complicated logic of Talmudic sages. The Talmudic sages take the position, well, one second. Just because you said that the essence of determining life is breath, that could be interpreted in two different ways. The Talmud's conclusion is, how do you know if a person's alive? You check their breath. But maybe there's two different ways to interpret that outcome. Either breath is a siba, is the cause of life, and the absence of breath is the cause of death. Or breath is a siman, is a sign of life, but not proof of life. It's kind of good evidence, but not the complete picture. And there are many post-game, and this is actually debated in medieval ages, even though there wasn't really that much of a practical outcome for it. There are many post-game who say that, no, Aristotle told us that the essence of life is in the heart and not in the nostrils. And they try to quote verses from other places in Tanakh that talk about the heart as the essence of the human life and not the breath. And so there are positions that say, and how do you explain this Gemara? This Gemara is just the barometer to tell if the heart is still functioning. But it's not the essence of life and death itself. And so maybe you could say that when the Talmud says you only have to check until the nostrils, right, that's just a siman. It's a sign of whether the heart is still functioning, but not the definition of life and death on its own. Okay, so where does this leave us? When this question first becomes really controversial is in the early years of heart transplants. I think heart transplants were the first transplants that really did require a person that allowed a transplant of an organ that, but the organ can only be taken if the heart was beating up to the moment in which it was taken. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was one of the first people to address this question. In his first response, his first halachic response about this in 1970, this is source 15, he says that any doctor who performs heart transplant is a rotzeach, is a murderer, and any person who has had their heart taken from them was murdered. It's a very strong position. This is also 1970. Does anyone know when the medically accepted definition of brain death was accepted in the United States? So I only know this because I taught this class once. 1981. So Rav Moshe's first tshuva, his first response is written in 1970, and he calls it murder. He wrote a second response in 1976, where he deals with two questions. This is a very famous tshuva for another reason, because it's a tshuva where Rav Moshe Feinstein said that if a person has a breathing tube, you're not allowed to remove it when there's still oxygen, but when the oxygen tank runs out, then you're not obligated to replace it. It's a very important halachic position for Moshe Feinstein, because it ends up leading to those who are lenient for end of care issues. He kind of suggested that not replacing air is an equivalent to just removing that loud noise from outside. It's like the thing that was stopping death from happening, but not the thing causing death itself. So that tshuva is important for other reasons. But in this tshuva, he also deals with a tragic case of a young boy who's brought to the hospital after a car crash. And the doctors do a test that we now know is called a cerebral angiography. I think he refers to it in the tshuva. A cerebral angiography is the test that, I think it was the first test to determine brain death. And what it involves putting, I think, some kind of dye into the bloodstream. And then through x-rays, you see if the dye went into the brainstem or not. And if the dye doesn't go into the brainstem, I think that is proof that the brainstem is not connected to the rest of the body. And so that would be the way to determine brain death. And it seems like Rav Moshe says that you can use that to determine death, but he doesn't say it in a very conclusive way, which leads other rabbis to start saying, don't you dare say that Rav Moshe Feinstein is changing his mind about brain death, because he didn't actually say it explicitly. And if he really meant it, he would have said it explicitly. 1981, the medically accepted opinion in America, the Harvard criteria for brain death, is published and accepted by the U.S. government as a second definition for what death is in America. So there's now pulmonary, complete irreversible pulmonary cessation is the classic definition of death. And now brain death becomes a second definition of death. There are two definitions of death, right? You don't need to run the cerebral angiography to declare someone dead. God forbid if there's a motorcycle accident and you find someone without any pulse and you try resuscitation and it doesn't work for, X number of times, people are declared dead on the scene without doing this testing. So in any case, Rav Moshe, there starts to be rumors about what is Rav Moshe Feinstein's position. 1981 is when brain death is accepted as law in America. And 1984, Rav Moshe allegedly writes a third halachic response on the issue. And I say allegedly, that response is source 19, where he says, I heard from my son-in-law, Rav Moshe David Tendler, parenthetically, this is Gav Shapira's rabbi in Muncie. Rav Tendler is a scientist and a halachic expert and a Rosh Yeshiva at YU. He's Rav Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law and has a lot of respect in the Orthodox world, but got into a huge amount of controversy over this and other issues. Because Rav Tendler tells Rav Moshe, oh, did you hear that the United States of America has accepted brain death as a definition of death, and therefore it's permitted to do heart transplants? And Rav Moshe, in this tshuva, it's addressed in 1984, but it's only published years later. It's published as the only it's the posthumous volume of Igra Moshe, the response of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And when it's published, Rav Moshe Feinstein in this tshuva dated 1984 explicitly says, I accept brain death as the definition of death, and therefore it is permitted to do heart transplants. It is permitted for heart transplants to take place once brain death has been established. However, many people start to say, this is a forged response of Rav Moshe Feinstein.
Who forged it?
Some people say it's his son-in-law who forged it in his name. So I am fortunate to not, I don't know the Feinstein family, but my Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Baruch Simon, spoke to this Rav Tendler, but also spoke to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's son, Rav David Feinstein, who still lives on in Staten Island and teaches on the Lower East Side. And Rav David Feinstein, who's not embroiled in this controversy around the forging, says that his father personally told him that was his position at the end of his life. And so this issue is very controversial. In the Haredi world, in the ultra-Orthodox world, it is virtually unanimous that no one accepts brain death as the definition of death, and therefore, in the ultra-Orthodox world, giving any life-sustaining organs as donations is tantamount to murder. The Israeli rabbinate under Rav Shapira, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Rav in the 1980s, the Israeli rabbinate accepted brain death as the definition of death in Israel. So that is, I believe that is accepted as law and as the rabbinate's code in Israel. However, the ultra-Orthodox community doesn't rely on it. It's an interesting kind of middle position. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who's a very famous decisor in Israel, he was in the Haredi world, but also very respected in the modern Orthodox world in Israel. He took the position, I think it's a fascinating one, that in Israel, when you're dealing with Jewish doctors and Jewish patients and Jewish donors and Jewish recipients, one should not do heart transplants. But in exile, when the majority of doctors and the majority of donors are not Jewish, he said, "Dina de malchuta dina, the law of the land is the law. If a certain society has defined death in a way that's acceptable to them, you can rely on that to be a recipient. You just shouldn't be a donor because we have our own Jewish laws that disagree." So that's an interesting mid position. It ends up leading it to its own ethical issues, which is, Jews receiving far more than they're giving when it comes to transplants. I'll finally finish with one last note, that there's a new or a relatively new technique that I didn't know about when I first taught this class, called DCD, controlled donation after cardiac death, which, if I understand it correctly, is basically a procedure where a person who's imminently about to die, instead of just being allowed to die in a hospital room, they're taken into an operating room. And they basically, as they're about to die, they might be taking them off of life support in that moment. They also start prepping the body for a donation that would happen immediately after a cardiac death. And this is halachically, this seems very problematic. I think the most important reason is A, that it often requires active taking someone off of life support, and B, even before or while they're being taken off of life support, their body is being injected with fluids that are going to help with the transplant immediately after they're declared dead. And so that goes back to just the issue of, right, you can't even close someone's eyelids if they're still alive.
Taking
right?
someone off life support is forbidden?
That's not a yes or no question.
Yeah.
That would require its own, an hour to, I don't know, 10 weeks to discuss in detail. There are many, many permutations of that question, so I can't answer them all at once. Say that again. Where they have a timer that shuts them off every few minutes.
Every few days.
My understanding is that medical ethicists, not halachic experts, view removing life support as ethically equivalent to allowing life support, to allowing the oxygen tank to just run out. From a medical ethics perspective, in the secular community, those are viewed as equal. In the halachic community, we actually have terminology about this. The Talmud says in certain prohibitions, shev al tase, sit passively and don't do something active, is far better than kumva said, and standing up and actively doing an action. There's a halachic distinction between those two things. And so allowing a timer to passively stop something, that's based on the Rav Moshe Tshuva. Technologies developed where it was a problem because no one was using oxygen tanks anymore because these machines were just creating their own oxygen constantly. I think that was the solution that some communities have come up with. And that's why when you're talking about taking people off of life support, it's a much more nuanced discussion than just yes or no. These are obviously very difficult conversations and meaningful ones, but I think one of the beauties of studying this inside is to see that our ancient sources actually have a lot to say about contemporary issues, even when it's a matter of life and death. And in this case, a slight difference in circumstance could be the difference between mitzvah or murder. So thanks everyone for being here. Have a great night.
Thank you.